Hello, grandkids, and welcome to OPA 37, part do, or take do, maybe, would be the more correct way to go about it. How about it, Ken?
Somehow that sounds disgusting, take do. But anyway, yeah, there was an episode that wasn't, you know, if we could take one of our patented peek behind the curtains. We had some technical issues and ended up talking for a little while without recording. Not sure what happened on that one.
Yeah, I will try and keep a tighter eye on the device. It worked just fine on Tuesday when I recorded with Chris. So I will hope that things run smoothly again this evening.
Yeah, I would hope so too.
And I will admit, I tend to keep a little bit more of an eye on it when we're here, simply because the computer is in a raised state here.
Oh, that's true.
And I kind of do a little more, I sit back some, which is probably why my voice fluctuates on these shows anyway. I feel like I sit back more at your place than I do here.
So do you feel like your voice fluctuates more when you listen back?
I don't listen back all that often.
Yeah, I probably should more too.
I do every now and again.
Yeah. Well, that was a little peek behind the curtain, guys. But this week, we're back at it again.
Wow.
And so far, we're...
it was so fascinating. I don't know why you didn't want to stick with that, Ken.
I mean, I know that... But I believe that you should always leave your audience wanting more. And we
it's
can't...
Just when it's a little peek behind the curtain.
Yeah, we got to break it up a little bit and, kind of parse it out to people. But the last episode... OPA number 36, is that right?
Yeah, well, the one before this, yes.
That's right. We,
Not the
not including
one.
The lost episode. Yeah. We were discussing matters of life and death, I guess you'd say.
Yes, we were discussing mort safes.
Mostly death, really.
And zombies.
Zombies, I guess, not really... Dead, right? Are they undead?
Yeah,
where do
they
we fall
are.
On? We didn't really get into that terminology, but
no, that was definitely not a topic in this this video that you presented to me, which is titled "What is Life? Is Death Real?"
Yeah, and it's really a good one if you want your mind to be blown. Like if you're looking, like maybe wait for yourself, you know, to be in the right kind of mental state that you're ready to say, like, hey. I want to see something that's just going to go like, boom, like make me really be like, whoa, like have a Keanu Reeves type reaction to something.
yeah, maybe you would have a reaction to this video. It is a very interesting thing. It's kind of funny that philosophy was certainly one thing in college that I blew off. And really kind of got annoyed by. But I don't know. There's some things within philosophy that if you don't... I guess I tend not to get too deep is what tends to be my problem. Is that I can deal with the surface stuff. But when you start getting into the nitty-gritty, I think I start shying away.
So what was the nitty-gritty for you with philosophy?
I don't really remember, to be honest with you. I just remember the general characterization in my head of the class. I was there much of the time, sleep deprived, and probably not in the best context to want to learn anything in general.
Yeah, well, I think that explains your general attitude towards the class, and I guess, you know, you got out of it what you put into it, really.
Yep.
But would you say that this got into it, this video took you to places that you weren't that thrilled about because of your disdain for philosophy?
No, because and that's what I was saying, is this is kind of more of a surface question.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, it's not, you don't have to get too detailed with it. It's kind of a yes or a no kind of vibe. And the philosophy part is like the real kind of mind-blowing part, I guess you'd say. Because the beginning, that it's a almost 6-minute video, and really the first 4 minutes or so is just them explaining life.
Right.
You know, like the general concept going from a cell the whole way up to, you know, functioning living organisms.
So they defined life at the beginning, and this is...
another philosopher.
Yeah, Erwin Schrodinger, I believe, was his name.
Yes.
And he had said that life resists decay into disorder and equilibrium. So whatever does that is alive. And basically, it's something that tidies things up. At least it tidies itself up, you know, and it keeps itself together over time.
Right.
If you want to think about it that way. But so the smallest thing you can say that's alive then is a cell. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. That's where they started. So I guess from their perspective, that's the smallest place to start.
Because
they didn't go into protons and that kind of situation.
I mean, they did get into like the parts that make up the cell. But
went
to say that those actually are not alive. They just react to things according to the laws of physics. But somehow all of those parts together, their interactions, create something that is alive.
Right.
Which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, that is the first thing they kind of touch on, where they're just trying to... you know, ask the question, what is alive? Like, at what juncture? And I felt like they captured most of what I would think would be a general sense of something being alive. Like, I think that people need some type of animation.
Sure.
I would say that people might argue, you know, for trees being alive, but it's a different argument to me when they talk about something like even a rabbit or a dog.
Yeah, I guess you think about like something that's not alive, like a bunch of talcum powder. You know, if you just threw that on the ground, it would just disperse and like go everywhere. But something that's alive is going to, like, stay together and, like, you know, keep itself around.
Yeah, it keep itself in some type of shape.
Yeah.
Even if it's injured, when it goes to the floor, it can recover.
Yeah, well, it'll try to, yeah, as much as possible.
Right.
And, yeah, it is strange to think that somehow from, you know, the level... smaller than a cell, the interaction of all these little things, like they're just like you could calculate, like, okay, if this happens here, then this little piece is going to do this. You know, there could be a formula somehow for all that stuff. But then when it comes to like that cell, like that's somehow, it's a living thing that's just going to act on its own, and it responds to, you know, stimulus. It you know, reproduces. But then, like, all these cells together combine to make, like, a, you know, other animals like me or you. It's
right.
Just pretty crazy. Or our other two animals in the room here.
Yep. One
little doggies.
Is sawing logs and the other is looking off into space.
I think she's trying to... ponder some of these same questions that we're grappling with here.
And I guess one of the parts when they were explaining the science was they were wondering if, since we're all just because everything stores memory. Like, that was kind of the other recurring theme without them really pounding on it, is that everything has a memory to take with it from, you know, they just showed a picture of a cow breeding, and then the different DNA strands for each cow that had been bred from it, and so on and so forth.
Right. Taking the point that, you know, I guess life is to, you know, is life DNA that just carries on through the generations, or combined through the generations, or somehow carried on. I don't know. But, you know, you need more than just DNA to have life. So it's kind of a interesting question, I guess. And then, like,
yeah.
I feel like there's other ways besides just, you know, purely genetic ways to carry on, you know, after you, you know, die. I feel like you leave other marks in the world besides just your genes, so.
Well, yeah, you could leave artificial life.
That's the other thing, yeah.
Which they certainly did touch on. So they're saying if we can make an inanimate object like us, you know, are we dead already?
Yeah, if, you know, somehow we were able to make a exact Android replica of ourselves or something, and upload our brains.
Yeah, the hotel in Japan is working on it.
Yeah, that's right. From a previous episode, our longtime listeners will no doubt remember the hotel that's going to be heavily staffed with robots, and hopefully, eventually, they're going to phase out all the humans there.
It's not artificial intelligence, but you're getting there.
You know, I thought something that you said earlier just kicked my memory. You know, I don't think we've ever talked about the Latro books on this podcast. Soldier of Mist, I think, is the first one.
Well, I think that's the title for the combined two. Let me get up and get it. Fill time, sir.
Sure.
Fill
yeah. No, I was just gonna say, because that deals with, I guess, it's in Greek times, so it deals with a lot of, or ancient, you know, I guess, you know, in some parts of the world, it still is Greek times when you think about it.
Well, yeah, you can, you could call it Greek times still.
Yeah, it could still be Greek times. But anyway, I'm referring to ancient Greeks, circa 400 BC, I want to say.
Oh, yeah, Soldier of the Mist.
Soldier of the Mist is the first book, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's seeing gods and things like that in there. And for some reason, he loses his memory, but he's able to see, like, all these supernatural things that, like, other people don't necessarily see. But sometimes they do see, which is kind of... Well, if he touches him, right, then everybody can see him.
Yeah, I believe that's the case.
So that's pretty crazy. But
yeah,
at one point, I remember him seeing... there's a couple times when he sees the spirits of dead people. And at one point, they mentioned something like, you know, this... it's their spirit, but it's the part of them that can't die because it was never alive, which I thought was pretty interesting.
I did not remember that, but that is very apt for this part of the discussion.
Yes.
It could be that, you know, ghosts are just some form of DNA that flashes back at some point. Just shimmers alive for a little bit.
Well, I don't know how that would exactly work. What part of the double helix would explain that kind of behavior? But you know what? Anything's possible.
Yep. We just haven't figured that out yet. The ghost
gene. It could be holograms from the future, for all we know. Or, I think it was Paul F. Tompkins who said something about that the ghosts might be poorly dressed time travelers or something like that. But, I don't know. It's hard to say, I guess, is what I'm saying. But that could be one explanation.
Yeah, one.
one of a possible myriad. A plethora of possible explanations. But, yeah, I like that part about what the part of you that is not, that doesn't die because it was never alive, which is interesting to think about, because there's parts of you that you could say maybe aren't alive right now, like your hair. Would you consider that part of you?
Probably. Hair and fingernails, you can definitely count, because, I mean, that is actually dead material. That happens to be passing through your skull.
You're also made up of, well, I mean, do you count, like, the bacteria that, like, live in your stomach that, like, break down, you know, food for you that help you, you know, survive? I mean, do you consider that to be part of you?
My stomach is part of me.
So, I mean, but these cells don't have your DNA, right? So,
right.
So it's kind of like a tricky...
So that's why the ghost is always light, always kind of skinny, shimmering.
I'm picturing Slimer from the Ghostbusters. Do the ghosts always like hot dogs?
I don't think they always like hot dogs.
No. All right.
I think that was just special to Slimer.
He did like hot dogs. I remember that part.
Maybe some of them like pork belly.
Pork bellies? Sure. I don't see why not. Although, it seemed like the food would just go right through the ghost.
So, yeah, it did not do them much sustenance.
So that could be a fool's errand for ghosts out there.
Any
of our ghost listeners, you might just want to not even bother, because it's just going to drop right through you. So I don't know. Oh, the other thing, we were talking about zombies.
Right.
And a lot of times there's the idea of contagion, really, spreading, like a virus almost, we'll say.
Right.
That was part of the simulator we were dealing with last week, actually.
Yep.
But this video brought up an interesting thing that I hadn't been aware of, that there's some viruses that can go into a dead cell, bring it back to life in order to act as a host for itself. Which does seem a little bit like a zombie virus to me.
Yeah, I do believe I had heard of a zombie virus previously to this video. So that wasn't too much of a surprise to me. It's still interesting and, it's pretty interesting.
Right. I mean, I don't think that this virus is at the point where it's like resurrecting like a whole organism necessarily. It just sounds like it's kind of bringing individual cells to, like, you know, life, I guess.
Oh.
But it's not like kickstarting a brain again and getting up and moving around, you know.
Yeah, it is not reanimating a corpse.
Right, yeah, just to be clear. We strive to bring truth and journalism here.
I guess it would still be in what you would call a living being. Or, I don't know, maybe after this video, do you call it a living being?
Towards the end of the video, they really get into the... what you would call the philosophical area.
And they say as much on a sign.
Yes.
So in the video.
You know what you're in for at that point. But like I said, if you're in the mood to get blown away by some concepts being dropped on you, this is a good video to check out.
We'll link to it as we usually do, or we might even put it in the header.
Woo!
Yeah, we're going to go 21st century on you. We're going to put a video up there.
That's crazy.
There is another thing that it's alive, maybe it's dead. I don't know.
Ooh, this is interesting.
Yes. I do remember, I did not remember the year in particular, though it was 1999. that Sony launched a robot dog.
Oh, yeah. What was this one called?
Abio.
Abio. Or Abio?
Or Abio, maybe? Yeah, I'm not sure how to... A-I-B-O. They did not give me a pronunciation key after it.
Okay, yeah. Sorry, we're going to just maybe vary our pronunciation just to cover all our bases throughout this discussion. But the Aibo was a very very popular. It seemed like it had a loyal fan base.
Yeah, it found a niche market, and because it went away, and honestly, I hadn't thought about it. I do remember it, but
because I remember
2006 is when they stopped producing them. So it only discontinued the bot in 2006 after selling around 150,000.
Ah, 150,000, yeah.
So, yeah, in 7 years, that is not really what you want to see as a sales total.
No, that's not a runaway success, I would say. So I guess I could understand why recently they announced they were going to stop supporting these Aibo robots. And,
yep. And people are now having Aibo dog robot funerals, because there are times where even the hardcore underground Aibo dog owners, they go to different mechanical vets to try and keep them alive.
Right. And there's internet, sites and forums where people are kind of sharing tips for how to, resurrect their Aibos.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, this whole thing, it reminded me of my dad's train, actually.
Okay, because people may not know. Yeah. Kevin's dad has a big train set he puts up.
Yeah, he has a Lionel O'Gage train set, and he's had it since either 52 or 53. He's not completely sure.
Well, that's quite a while ago.
Yeah. So, and he keeps it running. But there's only one repairman in the U.S., and he's in Pennsylvania here, I think near Pittsburgh, that does repairs on him anymore. Like, he used to know, like, three or four, but, like, the number of people that know how to repair these things now is dwindling quickly.
Wow.
And just because it's obviously so old, too, you can't really order new parts for it.
Yeah, I would imagine that they wouldn't just make parts like that anymore. But I wonder if they would still sell, like, I think on eBay sometimes you can find, like, broken things. Like, if you wanted to try to get parts that way.
Right.
But, yeah.
Well, it sounds like the Aibo owners here did something more like that. I'm not sure, again, at least 1999 is a little more recent than 1953.
Right, yeah. Your chances are better at finding parts by about 200%, I would say.
Of course, some asshat recently just smashed my driver's side windows and my rear window. Mm. And they actually had to order the rear window in from Ontario.
Ah.
So, you know, the parts are even scarce for the old Saturn at this point, and that was an O2. and they had to order the suicide door glass from Los Angeles.
Wow. So did the stuff ever come in, or is it still...
Yeah, my car is now repaired, but, you know, I guess just compared to this, like, I have something that's newer than this dog.
Right.
And I'm having a hard time getting parts.
Now, here's the question. If your parts finally ran out for your Saturn, you could not repair it any longer, would you have a funeral for it?
Well, and that was the other thing I did think about, because they talked about people's sentimental value to inanimate objects. And the Gray Ghost, as it was nicknamed, my first car, it was a Cutlass Caprice 79. I blew the transmission driving home from my last day at Bland's Park. And I actually made it back to my parents' place, but the vehicle would not start the next day. I did take a picture of it when we took it to the junkyard. Well, that picture is probably at my parents' house somewhere.
Yeah.
So, maybe the next time I go there, I'll try and, hunt that one down if they still have it.
Was there a little, extra moisture in your eyes there when you were dropping the ghost off at the, junkyard?
A little
dusty there.
Yeah, I mean, I actually, well, and again, to go back to the we're living in the future sometimes,
uh-huh.
And obviously not a joke, I had to tell my dad to bring the camera. Like, this wasn't like, hey, I have my phone with me, let's snap a selfie with my first car.
Right.
Like, I had to tell my dad to bring the camera with us, and he had to develop the, well, he didn't develop the film. I do believe he did that some, like, before we were born, some.
Huh. What kind of pictures was he taking, I wonder, that he didn't want to take him to somewhere to get developed? Makes you wonder.
I don't know if it was, it's, with as old as he is, it might have been quicker to develop your own at that point.
Oh, he could have just been impatient.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Well, that makes sense, too. Yeah, I don't know.
So, yeah, I can understand, like, when the Saturn goes, I have had it for a while, so there will be a little bit of sentimental attachment.
Yeah, and I guess, like, you're...
Maybe not quite as much as that first car, mm-hmm. but, yeah.
But your car is, like, not programmed to respond to you, either. The way, I guess, that this dog is. Although I do question how much it is and how much is just people projecting onto it.
Well, yeah, it was supposed to learn from your habits. And you could shut it down like, oh, it's a cat, and just go on vacation.
Right. It's not going to be sitting there whining the whole time.
Yeah, it doesn't need to go to a doggy hotel.
Right. You don't need to feed it, which is nice. But, you know, it's like, what?
Yeah, I think these people are a little overboard. Like I said, like, my attachment, it was there, but, like, I wasn't weeping over my car. Got a little tear in the eye, but I wasn't, like, slobbering on it and hugging it. Or even having a formal funeral for it.
At least you didn't have your dad take pictures of that part.
We did not take it to the trash compactor.
Well, no, I think that... But then again, too, if they had this since 1999, that's... how many years is that at this point? 20?
16 years.
16 years?
Yeah, depending upon what part of 99 it came out in.
So that if you had a pet that for that long, that would be a long-ass time.
Right.
Now, I'm questioning, because this 99, we're not talking, like, advanced AI, I don't imagine,
at this well, point. You already questioned how much it learned, and I had kind of forgotten that aspect of it, honestly. But yeah, it can't be that good at learning stuff.
I mean, what isn't this roughly around the same time as the Furby that was supposed to learn from your talking to it and stuff like that?
Oh,
I mean, it's somewhere around there, I think.
Yeah, I was wondering if you remember the great Furby incident at 31 East Lane.
Oh, geez. This sounds somewhat familiar.
Where the Furby ended up getting grilled.
Oh.
Someone deployed the Furby one too many times. And the Furby got grilled.
Like?
As a response to its overuse.
Wait, somebody asked it the hard questions? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, someone asked it the hard questions. It definitely... if it was alive before that, it was at least not functioning afterwards. If you consider Furbies to be alive.
Well, the Furby was introduced in 1998.
Okay, yeah, maybe an extra year of development. Well, not maybe. A year of extra development.
Oh, but they're still being produced today, so who knows?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. They could...
I did not know. Add that to the list.
Yeah, they could be ready to take us over any day now.
Yeah, but it's going to be like the Tribbles. That's the only only Star Trek I know about, I think.
Well, yeah, if once they get to the point where a Furby can reproduce itself, you know, from spare atoms that might just be laying around... then we're going to be in trouble. It's only a matter of time, as far as I understand it. Yeah. But, you know, we have other topics to move on to. We don't need to bum ourselves out by the coming Furby apocalypse.
Yes. Hopefully that will be after I'm dead.
Yeah.
When the Furby apocalypse hits.
We can hope. I think not in vain. They still have a little ways to go.
Somewhat futuristic topic here. You know what? Since this the article ends with it humanizes rather than commodifies the experience of eating, you sent me an article on tipping.
Yes, I did. This was the, I don't know. It has, for some reason, always seemed kind of like a weird thing to me. Like a very arbitrary practice that you tip people who bring you food. Like you give them extra money. Like, why is that the only thing that you do that for?
Yeah, it is kind of interesting because there are a couple of things in the article. It's always been a funny topic to me just because of Reservoir Dogs and Mr. Pink.
True, yeah.
Going bananas about not tipping. And I've just heard more about people trying to do away with tipping recently. I feel like this is... maybe not a hot topic, but certainly one since I do go to a lot of restaurants and food trucks of the like. I have experienced some of these things that they're talking about in this article, too.
Right. So, it kind of traces the origins of tipping, which was interesting to me, back to, like, an aristocratic custom that if when you were visiting someone, you know, your buddy's estate, you would leave some money for the servants because they had to do extra work, you know, because you were visiting. But they argue, I guess, that it still carries some of that connotation today, that you're kind of like, or it did carry that connotation at least.
Yeah, that you're above the person serving you.
Yeah.
And that's why they did broach that in the article. And the one person that they were talking to said that they didn't feel that way. And I do feel like the Food Network helped kind of elevate the eating place. Like, they made you more... Not that there weren't nice restaurants already, but they made you more aware of the chef.
Hmm.
And I feel like a lot of people, because of that, look at things a little bit differently than they used to. Yeah, just even 20 years ago.
Yeah, people have paid more attention to food-related issues, I'd say, for sure. More and more in recent years. Even with things like that you might think are controversial, like... what is the new allergy? Gluten allergies.
Oh, gluten allergies.
Yeah, or like gluten-free products is the thing.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely a segmentation going on. So I think that in a lot of ways people understand it more, even if they don't necessarily do that kind of thing that often. I think that there's at least a little more of an awareness of it.
Yeah.
I mean, because I know that plenty of people are still at Golden Corral on a Friday evening.
Well, yeah, that's true.
So there's only so much to go around. And actually, with the tipping, I always remember being told that any time, and it was later on, that buffet style was always tougher for the worker. And I never, I always worked in... I worked in three small kitchens or two small kitchens. Yeah, just the park and Panini's. I don't think I worked in any other kitchen. So I worked in two small kitchens, so I didn't really have to worry about that. Like, it was bar service at one place, and it was just counter service. You know, we were kind of a fast food joint at the park.
Yeah.
So I was definitely in the not tip category.
Yeah, so that's kind of a weird thing there.
Though we did get tips from time to time. But I was doing about the same amount of work at Panini's, honestly, because we just had grills and everything in front of us. A little bit of a walking space, case for beers is the overflow bar, and then the counter. So it wasn't like it was that big, and I served people just like I would have at the park, but I got tips there.
Hmm.
And I did appreciate the tips. Some of them weren't always used monetarily.
Interesting.
Yes. Some of them, some of our customers, repeat customers, always good. That's why it was kind of funny. They were talking about big groups not being good tippers. Yeah. Well, yeah, in the bar, you definitely dealt with a small amount of people.
Yeah, like
it's a one-on-one thing for the most part. Some people will order for their friends, but for the most part, in college, you're just ordering for yourself.
Every person for themselves. Yes.
But, so, yeah, I mean, I got to know people, and maybe they knew that we liked the little, you know, Mary Jane, so they'd pass that along as a tip from time to time.
Wow, okay. Well, that's a pretty good tip.
I was never all that... I guess I never felt demeaned. I just always hoped that somebody gave me money.
Yeah.
Like, it was just one of those things. It's just like, you know, be as friendly as you can and just... whatever, like, you can't really control that much. You know, be timely with getting the food out there and be friendly.
Yeah, that's what you can do. But, you know, I feel like people tend to just tip based on what they're going to tip, right? Like, is that basically how you do it? And it's usually a percentage of the, like, why is it when you're eating dinner that you're supposed to tip a percentage of the cost of the meal? Like, how does that make sense? Like, does it, if I order like a steak versus a sub, you know?
Yeah, versus the chicken dish even?
Yeah, like what?
There's a good $5 difference in there between the chicken and steak.
Yeah, like why, and I don't think it's that much harder to like bring out the steak to the table.
Bring out the steak. Bring out the steak.
I don't know if it takes more of like a mental concentration when you know you're dealing with a higher price item that you've got to like shepherd out there. And then sometimes there's, you know, expediter people who do that too. But I don't know. Like, why is it tied to price? Does that make any sense as a percentage?
Not really, because the more expensive restaurants, well, I guess to me it's kind of funny. The more expensive the restaurant, the better the service typically is,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion. There usually tends to be less people for the waiters to worry about. So that helps. And, well, the food's more expensive. So even though they're doing, and I mean, they're really doing the same job that everyone else is doing. They're just dressed nicer. And, well, is some of the nicer some of the really nice restaurants, the waiters know exactly what they're giving you. Like, they are trained to tell you, like, if you ask them about any dinner, they can give you some type of a review on it. Where if you go to McDonald's, you can't ask them really. Well, you might be able to ask them how the McRib is.
Okay, so I think I see what you're saying here. So, like, the restaurant is going to, you're going to pay a little bit more in general for better service, where you're paying more money in general because, in general, the wait staff is going to be better.
Right, yeah.
So that makes sense to tie it to a percentage of your bill.
Yeah, I mean, it roughly. Like, I'm not saying that some of those people that are in the lower paying jobs are assholes or anything, but
right.
It's also that they tend to be less formal, which is fine, too. Like, it's just a different experience. I don't think that there's a difference in quality of food sometimes. You
it
know,
probably
like
depends on the place. Yeah.
Yeah, there are some greasy things that I would probably compare to I always go back to last year at WrestleMania. And we went to Emeralds, because it was just one of the places that I'm really thinking of for those examples. I had a whole spotted trout from the Lake Pontchartrain. And, I had to give him a big tip. It was $38 for that fish.
Wow.
It was worth every cent that I paid for it.
Okay, well, that's a good question. Like,
but there are also things to me that would be like some greasy sandwich that would be probably just as good. But it's like just a completely different good.
Huh.
You know what I mean? But the price of the ingredient and how they acquire it, too, is part of the problem.
All right, but to me, like, that fish might be more difficult for the cook to make, you know? For the chef versus the waiter. So it's like,
oh,
why, like, the chef is getting paid the same amount no matter what he's doing.
Right.
Even though some of the stuff that is more expensive is going to be harder for him, I would say. And, you know, the server is doing the exact same thing, basically, but then getting more money on these more, you know, basically on the increased labor from the chef. Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me. That part.
Well, that is true. I would say that took the chef years of work to get to that level of cookery. That guy, I know that it was not Emerald back there cooking my fish, but whomever did that work is very good at their craft.
Right. So why can't Emerald just pay, you know, or whoever, just pay their servers like what they would pay their chefs, or something that's going to be enough, that's a fair rate, and then you don't have to do these tips.
Yeah, and I mean, that is the case. I remember when we went to Italy, we were told not to tip. Like, yeah. They warned us up front that it's just like, that's no bueno. And it's just like, oh, okay, this is weird. And that they did actually start this article talking about that, wondering whether that was an outdated notion, but it wasn't, at least there.
Right.
But in England, you just kind of, well, where it all started, they're still doing the tip over there. And the one guy provided a perfect example, which wasn't surprising. He was in England, and he said he did away with tips, so he just raised the prices. But then he lost customers because his if you looked at his prices compared to, you know, the other high-end restaurant, their prices were cheaper. And I'm like, yeah.
But you're
like,
not figuring in the extra, you know, 20% or whatever for tips.
Yeah, for tip.
Yeah, that's true. Because some people, I guess it would almost have to be something where they made like a law where everybody had to basically do away with tips. And so then everybody would be on the same playing field, you know?
Yeah, like, and it took me back to, I was not a fan of the smoking being taken out just altogether. I really? Thought that people should have had the right to leave it in their bar. I think that because most of the places where there were still areas that you could go to smoke, most of those places were still facing massive losses from when their surrounding places didn't have smoke. Yeah. Like, they were still losing customers.
What are you saying now?
If there was still a smoking area in Columbus somewhere.
There was?
Yeah, for a little bit when the law first got passed. I forget, there was the township.
Oh, okay.
That wasn't part of Columbus, but it, you know, it was like inside the 270 belt.
Oh, all right, yeah.
So they still allowed smoking there, but people didn't flock to go there just to go to those restaurants to smoke.
Gotcha.
So that's, you know, like, even though there was something reasonable nearby, people still chose to go to the non-smoking Applebee's closest to them rather than driving to the Applebee's down in Rome.
Yeah.
For those of you, I don't know, 20, 30 miles outside of where you live, instead of going to the one that's 2 miles away.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense in that case. I mean, you can still smoke outside, so, like, people can make do.
Yeah, and that's what people ended up doing, and I guess that's what I was trying to get across. Like, I guess to me it should have been the establishment's choice, and if they chose to do it, I think that they would have lost business. Like, I much prefer the smoke-free environment, don't get me wrong. Because when we go back to Altoona every time, our one friend still runs the bar, Aldo's, or whatever, it's called McGarvey's now.
McGarvey's.
But they still have smoking, and I hate it every time I go in there. Wow. I hate, because I come back to my parents' place, and I just reek of smoke.
Yeah, that's pretty annoying.
Yeah, I just really don't, like, and I know that I did that a lot when I was younger. Like, I'm sure I came home smelling like a chimney, even though I never smoked. Well, I shouldn't say never smoked. I smoked for maybe about a month in my life.
Well, yeah, it's, and then you realize that gets all on your clothes and, like, your
body. But I didn't realize how bad it stunk, I guess, at first. But yeah. Then, like, the more it got eliminated, the more I noticed how much that scent stuck out. Like, when it's everywhere, you don't think about it.
Right. Yeah. I think we did. Yeah. We were probably at a younger age and didn't care about such niceties as much back then either. But at least in my case, I would say that was true. Yeah, you definitely smell like cigarette smoke if you go to a bar with a lot of people smoking. It's funny how that turns out to be true. I didn't realize they still allowed that in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, they skirted around it. There is a ban in Altoona for the most part now, but they got around it somehow and they've left it that way at the bar. And again, like, I like going to the other bar. Not, there are a decent chunk of choices in Altoona, but there's about two of them I hit now. Two of them have a good enough selection of beverages.
Do you want to give them a shout out?
Well, the Knickerbocker Tavern is the other one.
Yeah.
That is a fine establishment with many a sippy time beer. And some of them have appeared on the site.
Yeah, if you're ever finding yourself in Altoona, go ahead and look up the Knickerbocker Tavern. It's kind of a, it's a neat little place there. It's kind of like in there with residential looking buildings, so it's kind of a strange area.
Parking is a bit of a bear.
Yeah, that's true.
But and the establishment itself, not the most open of places.
Yeah, it's the layout is like you go in to like a small room with a bar, and then you can go past there, and like there's other rooms, but it's like all sequential.
So you're kind of in a mini maze.
Yeah,
because you have the bar on one side and booze on the other, or just bathroom. Like there's always something in seating beside you.
Yes.
So it's kind of a tight space.
Yeah, it's a long hallway, meandering hallway of sorts. But they've got a good selection of drinks there. And I would say it's maybe one of the cooler places to hang out in Altoona.
Yeah, that kind of helps too. It can be a little more laid back. It does not get as crowded as some of the other bars in town.
Yeah, it's a totally cash experience. You know, just relax, a night out.
And we do tip them.
That's true.
And, you know, that's the other funny thing is I always thought about tipping a lot.
Let me get in with a question here first.
Oh, okay.
When you're tipping your bartender, now, if you're buying a more expensive beer, would you tip more versus a cheaper beer?
Well,
would you base that on percentage at all?
I used to when I was in college and more of a drinker, I was taught to always have cash.
Okay.
Was always more attractive.
Who taught you this?
I don't know.
Obi-Wan Kenobi?
Yeah, someone. One of my college friends who was 21 already.
Sure.
I don't really remember. Oh, you know what? One of the dudes in our architecture class actually was a bartender. Like he was a professional bartender at a nicer restaurant.
Okay, so he wasn't an amateur bartender.
No.
All right. He had his license in bartending.
Yeah, he was like Tom Cruise in Cocktails.
Completed his bachelorette work and moved on to his doctorate. Well, cool. So, so you did tip more for more expensive drinks?
Well, then I wouldn't buy more expensive drinks, but then I felt like it was more important to pay the person up front. In a bar situation where I know I'm going to keep on coming back time after time.
Yeah. So, like, don't run up a tab?
If I got my first beer in college, I would throw down, like, $5. Like, if it was a $6, you know, if it was only, like, a $4 beer or something, yeah. I'd throw down, like, a $5. So, it's just, like, to get their attention.
It's like, holy... This guy's dropping Lincolns over here.
Yeah. I mean, come on. It's college kids. You don't need that much to get a bartender's attention.
I love that the bartender, like, you know, the action stops. Everybody just, like, turns and looks. Holy shit. That's a $5 bill. This guy's a big spender. But, yeah.
Well, and then I'd probably tip my second highest to the second beer that I got to make sure that, you know, they still knew that I was a good tipper.
Right.
And then I would start just doing singles after that.
So you would play with their expectations.
Yes. to hope that they'd know me. And then, you know, at the end of the night, I was still probably tipping more than anybody else.
Yeah. For some reason.
I mean, after three beers, I'm already talking about $10 of tip.
For some reason, I'm always thinking about a dollar a drink for some reason. It's like what I think about tipping bartenders.
Oh.
And it's probably, you know, variable based on the price of the drink. But that's just kind of where I have ended up over the years.
Yeah, I do, and I said do.
Well, I'm going to shout out from the gallery on that one. You did say doo-doo, though.
It's more like a dollar a beer now. Because, yeah, I mean, it's still about $5 or $6 a beer. There aren't too many beers that are that much pricier. There are some of the Imperial Stouts are expensive, and some of the higher level IPAs are usually a little more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, I feel like beers have a pretty level playing field. Unless you're talking major distributors craft beer, then there's a price difference. But because I'm not really up on what a Miller Lite costs these days, I'm going to stay out of that conversation.
Yeah,
I know that there's a price difference.
You're too highfalutin to deal with the plebeians.
The funny thing though is that the one thing that I do at the Blue Jackets games is that I always get the IPAs, or usually get the IPAs, because they give them to you. Get a 24 ounce can for $8, or you can get a 16 ounce of an IPA, which is, you know, usually sitting between 7% and 11% alcohol. Which, compared to, you know, even the Labatt is like 4.9 or 5.1 maybe. It's a time and a half of the alcohol, sometimes two times the amount of alcohol in there.
Yeah.
So, I'm getting less beverage, but I'm also getting more alcohol within the smaller container. And it's the same price. It's $8, too.
Right.
So, it's a...
You can make
cost
that,
efficiency.
Make yeah. that last longer, and then, you know, it'll carry you through the whole game.
Yeah, exactly.
That's smart economics.
All this talk about sippy time beer, and I guess we should just end right here by talking about Rogue's Irish Celtic Lager.
Mm.
And that went down entirely too smoothly, in my humble opinion.
Well, I don't know about too smoothly, but yeah, I quite enjoyed it. It had a very light taste to it, I guess. But I guess that could sound bad, but...
It did have a light taste, but it had more body than a light beer would.
Yes.
Without, I know that I've tasted Miller Genuine Draft somewhat recently.
What is this? Carrot cake balls.
And as everyone's favorite part of the show continues, the baking corner with the lady, we have carrot cake balls that are for the fish fry tomorrow.
Correct.
I was going to say, these look like they're somewhat St. Patrick's Day themed here with the green.
You are correct.
Yeah.
Yes, so a little bit of green sprinkle on there. they go along with the Irish Celtic Lager and, all the Irish themed, things of this week. So, for at Gozer 33, at DeFrango 11, at Stunt Granny in general, this has been a technical difficulty free show.
That's right.
Maybe not with my mouth, but yeah. At least with the hardware that we use to record my mouth. Everything went smoothly.
That's well put, Kevin. And everybody, have a good week.